Support comes from PERIC, working to construct the spaces where the St. Louis community works, learns, and grows. More at PERIC.com.
St. Louisans love to tell stories. When I walked into the home of Elle and Troy Kabrodsky, they started pulling stories right off the shelves.
Troika is a collector of movie props. So this is actually from Doctor Who. Yeah. Over here in the case is the Sex Panther cologne from Anchorman.
I had this massive collection of Star Wars stuff. I am the guy that like auction houses call when they need to authenticate like a lightsaber.
He had, at the time, the largest collection of Lord of the Rings movie props in private hands other than Peter Jackson himself.
Yeah, I had everything. I had, like, a Ringwraith costume and Frodo's sword and Gimli's axe. And
the inside of our wedding rings is engraved with my precious.
It's a weird hobby, and by looking at the two of you, this is what I get from most people, which is indifference.
Oh, no, this is awesome.
Sometimes people will be over, and I'll hand them like a Harry Potter wand, and they'll lose their mind.
Their home has its own stories, too. It's got the kind of quirks that you'll find in a lot of century-old St. Louis houses.
We call that the murder room.
Yeah.
Like it is fairly terrifying. There's stairs in the basement in one place that just go up to the ceiling and stop. Mm-hmm. There's a section of the basement that is just dirt floor, like a lot of basements in St. Louis.
At one point, it was a boarding house carved into multiple apartments, and it may or may not have been a brothel for some time. All of that on its own would have been enough for a good story. But the thing that brought me up to their front door was something else.
My parents sleep in the county, and I sleep in the city.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
That's Elle and Troika's son, Daniel. And he's talking about an issue that's fairly unique to the St. Louis region. It's something that dozens of families have to learn how to navigate. The Brodsky home sits right on top of the city-county border.
Yeah, on the survey lines and stuff, there is a street right across the street there, Limit. That's the line on a survey map. And then if you just draw that straight across, it cuts basically right across our front door and sort of goes diagonally this way.
The invisible line that splits the city of St. Louis from St. Louis County also splits their property into two different municipalities. That makes everyday things, things that should be simple, a lot more complicated. They didn't know where to go to get a library card. When they call emergency services, it's like a bureaucratic coin flip.
You know, 911 answers and is like, okay, so I'm getting your location. Is this the city or the county?
On the road, directly in front of their house, there's a sinkhole-like cave-in, a dip in the road that sits right in the middle of Limit Avenue. And it only ever seems to get half fixed every few years.
I mean, literally, you can see the line in the road from where the city worked up to a certain point and the county worked up to a certain point. But they were both dealing with half of the same sinking issue, but they weren't working together. They weren't working on the same schedules. And then the city had to come back and do more of what they had done because how they did it the first time wasn't holding up compared to how the county's was.
Even trash and recycling pickup is a little awkward.
So they come, they pick up right here, and then they literally back up after they pick up our trash. You hear the truck, and then you hear it go beep, 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 and they're just like, yeah. Like working their way away from the
that's
county
the,
line.
That's the sound of me cursing that I haven't gotten our recycling out that's in time true. When I hear that.
And what about their taxes? Who do they pay?
Most of our taxes goes to the city. We're not paying twice as much and paying, you know, full on to both. So as far as I know, everything's on the up and up. We've had lawyers look at things. We've got contracts. But it is weird.
It's weird and a little absurd. All because of a line on a map. Why do the Brodskys and so many other St. Louis families along the city-county border have to navigate between different local governments? To answer that, we have to go back to 1876, to a decision now known as the Great Divorce, when voters in St. Louis agreed to split from the rest of the county. That vote came only 11 years after the Civil War. And now, 150 years later, that divorce still shapes daily life in the region. Meet me at the border. I'm Luis Antonio Perez, and this is Meet Me, a new project from St. Louis Public Radio about connecting across divides to find a way forward. We're starting this work by exploring the past, present, and future of one of St. Louis's most persistent divides, the separation of St. Louis City and St. Louis County. It all begins with an event that this year will mark its 150th anniversary, the historic event known as the Great Divorce. St. Louis sits on ancestral lands that others had previously called home, including the Osage, Missouri, and Sauk and Fox people. The century starts with the Louisiana Purchase and the expedition of Lewis and Clark, heading up the Missouri River to map out the new territory claimed by the United States. The return of the explorers marks the opening of the new frontier, an invitation to go west and expand the country. To American leaders, St. Louis becomes the gateway, a natural jumping-off point for future explorers, traders, and settlers heading west. A great city at the confluence of two rivers and of commerce, history, and politics. In its first century, St. Louis was caught in the fight over slavery. Dred Scott sued for his freedom here, a flashpoint that historians say pushed the country closer to war. After the bloody Civil War, westward expansion resumed, and the people of St. Louis expected great success from their booming river town. That confidence, and maybe overconfidence, is what set the stage for the Great Divorce, a decision that would permanently reshape St. Louis, with consequences that are still being felt today. One of the first people I called to help me understand the city-county divide was Andrew Wonko. He's a public historian with the Missouri Historical Society.
You cannot get very far into St. Louis history without coming across one particular topic, and that is the city-county divide, this invisible Berlin Wall that has divided St. Louis City and County for more than 150 years.
Andrew suggested I start with the book he comes back to time and again, Terry Jones's Fragmented by Design. It helped me understand why the city border exists at all, and why it's so unique.
Yeah, so St. Louis stands with a very small group of other major American cities that is set up this way, where the city governs itself as an independent county, independent of the surrounding county around it. I'm fascinated by it because whether you live in the city, the county, or elsewhere in the region, you are somehow, your experiences as a St. Louisan are flavored by this issue on a daily basis. But it's not just you. If your parents lived here, if your grandparents lived here, everything that they did as a St. Louisan all kind of points back to this line. It shaped where they lived. It shaped the decisions they made. It shaped the biases and prejudices they had against people who are our fellow St. Louisans living within the city and the community alongside them. So I'm fascinated by this idea because it's so crucial to understanding St. Louis as a place. It's so ingrained into this city. But if you ask the average person why it happened in the first place, it's usually a shrug. They have no real understanding. It's just always been that way.
So let's try to understand why. Why has the St. Louis border been this way for so long? It starts with the different services that people needed, depending on where they lived and worked. In mid-1800 St. Louis, people got to where they needed to on foot or by horse. And the region just looked very different from how it does today. The urban core stretched roughly 3 miles west from the riverfront, and the whole area, all the way out west to where Wildwood is today, was recognized as one big piece of land, 589 square miles of St. Louis.
Back in 1855, sort of when the story starts, St. Louis was one of the 10 largest cities in the nation. You had 310,000 people crammed between the edge of the river and Jefferson Avenue, this incredibly dense, walkable city where you had all of this action taking place. So that was St. Louis, and then the rest of what is now the western portion of St. Louis City and St. Louis County was essentially thin-spread farm fields, wild Missouri prairie. So you had these very few settlements out in St. Louis County, and the rest of it was just open farmland.
Prairie and farmland, just a few miles from the center of a growing boomtown. Confidence in the city's prospects was high. So high that there was even a serious proposal to move the U.S. Capitol from Washington, D.C. to St. Louis. Logan Uriah Revis was one of St. Louis's loudest cheerleaders. In his book, St. Louis, the Future Great City of the World, published in 1870, he wrote,
"St. Louis must be viewed in the light of her future, her mightiness in the empire of the world, her sway in the rule of states and nations. Her destiny is fixed. Like a newborn empire, she is moving forward to conscious greatness and will soon be the world's magnet of attraction."
At the time, St. Louis was divided into seven large regions. Townships like Carondelet, Merrimack, Bonham, St. Ferdinand, and St. Louis City, each with their own representation in county government. On paper, the townships were designed with future planning in mind, but in practice, it created an imbalance of power. The open townships around St. Louis City had a combined 5 votes, but the dense riverfront city held just 2 votes.
This is what really starts the ball rolling on what ultimately becomes the Great Divorce, because the city now is sending all of its tax money to the wider county, and they are getting to decide, you want to build a sewer over here? Well, I don't think we're going to do that, but Farmer John over here, he needs a bridge to get out to his farm. We'll build him a bridge with all that tax money. So the city feels itself tethered to this rural community, to a place that didn't understand its needs. It was buckling under the weight of all of this industry and immigration, and it needed to lay out sewers, you know, literally to keep people healthy. And that's where you get this tension arising.
Mm-hmm. So it's not just that, like, our money's going over there and we're not getting it back, but also, like, it's those people that has got our money.
Certainly. And I think it's very easy to look back at this issue and think, this is crazy. Why would they do this? Didn't they see what was going to come down the line? Couldn't they understand how this would be a problem? But when we look back at it, it is nuanced. I think there are very few people who would accept the situation as it stood in that moment, where you had 1/10 of the population with a dramatically outsized vote and control over 90% of the remaining population. That flies in the face of American democracy as we know it, that there was a real problem here, but the solution that came out of it obviously would have quite a few problems of its own.
The city's elites and industrialists needed a way to wrestle power from rural St. Louisans and redirect tax dollars to serve the needs of the growing urban core.
They could petition the state of Missouri to try to get more seats on the county court, the sort of democratic approach. We got 90% of the population, we deserve 90% of the representation. They knew that would go down in flames because you'd essentially be asking people to give up their power out in the county, and that rarely goes well.
And an effort to dramatically change the way people vote and interact with their local government usually takes years, if not decades, of debate, political wrangling, and legal fights. The city leaders needed a way to avoid all those problems. And it had to be something swift, a mechanism to quickly and decidedly circumvent those potential problems.
They get their lucky break almost immediately after they're planning all of this. In 1875, the state of Missouri convened a constitutional convention to rewrite the state's constitution.
A constitutional convention is a rare event. It's a gathering of statewide leaders to open the vault and make changes to the most important legal document in the state. Think of it like updating your computer by actually opening it up and rearranging the hardware, not just clicking download update. The separatists realized this was their golden opportunity.
If they could write separation into the highest document in the state, they could get around all the parochial infighting with St. Louis County. They could go straight to the top.
At the Constitutional Convention of 1875, while Missouri delegates argued about things like establishing a stable legal framework for the state and mandating separate schools for Black children, the St. Louis delegates quietly etched two provisions into the Missouri Constitution. Those provisions would let St. Louisans decide on whether the city and county should separate and where to draw the line between them. With that new constitutional authority, St. Louis would put it to a vote. All St. Louisans, residents from the base of the Eads Bridge on the Mississippi out to the railroad village of Eureka on the Merrimack River 25 miles away, rural and urban residents alike, would settle the issue of separation at the ballot box.
I was amazed the first time I actually saw the language in the Missouri State Constitution, Article 9, Section 20, that allows St. Louis City to separate itself. It's 376 words. It's a paragraph. Mm-hmm. Those 376 words are the source of all of the bias and prejudice and statements that are made. It's dangerous there. It's boring there. It's this, it's that. All of that stems back from this one single moment, this simple bit of text that allows St. Louis City and County to go their separate ways.
St. Louis could now start the process of separation and draw a new boundary line. But how did they decide where that line would go? When I look at maps of the city today, the border is stark and the shape is a little odd. On the east, the Mississippi River creates a rounded edge out along a couple of bends in the river. The western border, entirely man-made, is also slightly curved out with a thin strip extending north upriver. It makes this irregular oblong shape with a little panhandle at the top. Why has St. Louis been shaped like this for 150 years.
The guys who actually drew it, it was 11 wealthy white St. Louisans who drew that line. They met 52 times across the course of 3 months to actually figure out where that line would go.
To make that weird line?
Yeah, and occasionally, it's funny when you look at the newspaper coverage of the time of the arguments these guys were having. Sometimes they were having arguments like, we should actually go out and walk the line ourselves to make sure we know what we're getting. And another guy's going, we're not gonna walk out through cornfields. And they're getting in these little, you know, bickering fights. They're kind of a foreshadowing of what's to come as a result of all this.
They wanted to capture a few important parts of the landscape. On the south, they wanted the River de Pere, the backbone of the St. Louis sewer system. And they wanted the four new city parks, Carondelet Park, O'Fallon Park, Tower Grove Park, and Forest Park.
And then the city limits would jump upward on its northern edge, this tiny little sliver of land, to grab the chain of rocks where St. Louis City knew they wanted to eventually build a waterworks and did in the 1890s, still provides our drinking water today. So they were very careful about crafting this line to grab what they needed, but not grab too much of the surrounding county because they didn't want to be saddled down with taking care of all that. This is the problem they found themselves in the first place. If they grab too much land, all of a sudden they're back to building farmers' bridges and putting in gravel roads.
Remember, this was before cars and highways would revolutionize how people get around. Most of that new land the city acquired, west of Grand to Forest Park, was farmland and open prairie. Expanding the border by 300% seemed like enough.
They think this is going to last forever. They think they are going to get generations upon generations of people filling out this empty space in what is now Western St. Louis City. The reality is, in less than 30 years, it would be almost entirely filled.
It wasn't just the short-sightedness of the decision that historians have an issue with. Another problem was how the decision was passed.
Probably the most frustrating thing about this whole story is when you know, with the 2020 hindsight vision that we have today, what this is going to do to St. Louis in the coming decades. St. Louisans probably never actually voted to separate themselves from St. Louis County.
St. Louisans probably never actually voted to separate themselves from St. Louis County. Or did they? The new Missouri Constitution required that separation, the divorce, had to pass by a simple majority vote. Separatist boosters were made up of affluent elites in the city. they stood to gain most from the economic development boom that separation was expected to bring. These boosters launched a campaign to convince the soon-to-be city and soon-to-be county residents that separation was a good thing for both parties. The campaign focused on lower taxes and more checks and balances on local government. It was a chance for each side, rural and urban, to be free from the problems of the other. No worrying about Farmer John's bridge or the city sewers. Only a few months after the Constitutional Convention, St. Louis put it to a vote.
The vote goes public in August of 1876, and the separatists who crafted this whole thing are shocked when the results come back 52% against separation. The vote failed.
The vote failed. By a 5-point margin, St. Louis voted not to separate. But the wealthy movers and shakers of St. Louis City, the separatists, didn't let it stop there. They wanted an investigation, and they were lucky. The judge appointed to oversee the legal battle was deeply pro-separation, and he designated a 5-member commission to look into the vote. Historians James Neal Prim and Terry Jones, in their books about St. Louis history, note that the commission found massive voter fraud. And there was fraud. County officials who were generally opposed to separation ran the election, and some admitted to stuffing ballot boxes with no votes. In some precincts, there were more no votes than the total number of voters in the entire precinct. After a recount, nearly 4,000 votes were thrown out, including all of the votes in 3 precincts. Most of the ballots that were thrown out were no votes. And now, separation actually passed. It flipped 53-47 in the affirmative. A victory in the courts. So in a matter of 2 years, not decades, St. Louis City manages to officially and constitutionally divorce itself from St. Louis County.
And that's why it's so hard to undo, because it is literally written into the state's highest governing document. And they didn't write in an escape hatch. They didn't put in any sort of clause about, hey, well, what if we try this and it doesn't work so well? Here's how we can undo it. There was no back button to hit. Basically, the language as it was written is once this happened, it has happened permanently.
And let's make something clear about the power dynamics of 19th century America. Women and Black St. Louisans in 1876 had no say whatsoever about whether the city and county should separate. The Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act were still 4 generations away.
This is almost exclusively being dictated by the wealthy politicians and businessmen of St. Louis.
Over the 150 years since this great divorce, there have been many attempts at reunification. But in each of those tries, residents in both the city of St. Louis and the county couldn't find the heart for reunion.
And this is the case you'll see in every one of these situations. It changes which side feels like they're the dominant partner who would be marrying down if the two did get remarried. But it's always one feeling like it's the big shot and trying to leverage its weight over top of the other one.
And those perceptions about the differences between city folks and county folks continue to this day. Another outcome of the Great Divorce was that it led to municipal fragmentation across the county. Lots of itty-bitty little cities. At one point, 91 municipalities in St. Louis County, and now only a few less. The largest municipality has a population of just above 50,000, and the smallest, less than 10 people. And many people like it that way.
So one of the big arguments made about why this is a good thing in St. Louis County is it localizes control as much as possible. People have as much control over their immediate surroundings, and that's inherently a good thing. It gives them the power. But that power obviously can be abused in a number of different ways.
The puzzle of having so many St. Louis County municipalities led to several issues, like intentionally majority white communities, predatory policing, and traps designed to extract dollars from neighboring majority Black cities through court fees and traffic tickets. In 2014, the North County city of Edmondson was in the news because the mayor sent a memo telling the city's police officers to help pay their salaries by writing more traffic tickets.
So when you look at something like the Ferguson uprising in 2014, you can see how a lot of the issues present in Ferguson that were being protested against, all of that coming to life, that has all been crafted by decades of this city-county divide and this issue of micro-municipalities up in the region and police essentially seeing minority residents as a source of income.
Which brings up the longest thread in St. Louis history. From its founding in 1764 up through today, there has been no issue more consistent than the myriad ways that African Americans have been mistreated in the city, region, state, and country. One of the central issues with every reunification attempt over the last 65 years has been how a city-county merger would impact Black political power.
The Black voice of North City and County becomes a really huge presence because they're rightly saying, this will dilute our power. This will take even more away from people who have struggled to have a voice for so long. And so I think until you really start contending with those issues and really start listening to people, it's always going to be a non-starter.
And we'll get deeper into questions about reunification and how people feel about the effect it would have on Black political power in St. Louis in the next episode of Meet Me. With all that said, there are a few examples of the city and county finding ways to work together. The Metropolitan Sewer District manages the collection of wastewater and stormwater for thousands of miles of sewers in the city and most of the county. The Zoo Museum District, through a small property tax of city and county residents, supports major arts and cultural institutions like the St. Louis Zoo and the Missouri Historical Society. And Great Rivers Greenway maintains an elaborate network of trails across the region. But by and large, the city and county have remained separate and apart, divorced, marked by the same border that was created 150 years ago. One of the first things I did when I moved to St. Louis was look at a bunch of maps, satellite maps and historic maps online. They're beautiful and fascinating. As a historian, Andrew Wonko likes to study maps too. In particular, he likes to find examples where the St. Louis city-county border is very clear, then becomes entirely invisible.
Yeah, so one of my favorite spots is in Maplewood, right on the line. There's 2-block-long Limit Avenue, where you could stand with 1 foot in the city and 1 foot in the county, right down the center. And if you look in the distance, there's a house right there, and the county line goes straight through the middle of it. These people, you know, walking back and forth between their house must cross that line 100 times on any given day. It's just this fascinating, weird look at how invisible man-made lines don't always respect the actual community that is being built around them.
That house that Andrew's talking about, that's the Brodsky home that we visited at the beginning of the episode. Elle and Troika are still figuring out all the intricacies of living in a house divided by the border. And so is Daniel.
The bathroom upstairs is like right in the middle of city and county. Oh, it's right split.
So you're aware of where the line is?
I don't know.
You just know that half the house is in one place and the other half's in the other.
Yeah, because the sign is right where our house is.
There is the little sign right out front that says, you know, you're entering the city or you're entering Maplewood.
The Brodskys don't just live on the border. They think deeply about all the divisions in St. Louis, about the current and historic issues that have fractured the region over the decades. And they know, like many St. Louisans do, that the solutions we need to mend these harms will need to be bigger than what any one person or group can do alone.
There has to be some sort of consistent through line and vision and leadership that just isn't happening. There are some very, very tough challenges that go back a very long time, and even with vision and leadership and resources, these are not things that anyone is going to be able to clean up overnight. And the reality may be that it's just really messy. It's been really messy for a long time, and I don't know what you do about it. I certainly know the challenges facing our city don't come from a population that doesn't care. Like, we're awesome. I I love St. Louis people. There's so many people that care deeply and work so hard. But I don't know big picture what the solution is. I don't, but geez, we gotta keep putting one foot in front of the other.
In Troika Brodsky, we hear a sense of possibility, of what could be. Echoes of the promise that St. Louis boosters saw when they wanted to make St. Louis the nation's capital. But how do you begin to bridge a divide that's 150 years deep, or any divide for that matter? With Meet Me, we start by listening and talking to try to understand how we got here and how we move forward. In our next episode, part two of our deep dive into the Great Divorce, we'll hear what local leaders have to say about coming together and what they learned from one of the most well-researched and organized efforts to bring St. Louis together once and for all, and how it all came tumbling down. You've been listening to Meet Me, a project from St. Louis Public Radio about connecting across divides to find a way forward. Share this episode with your family and friends, and follow us on Instagram at MeetMeSTL. We also have a newsletter for Meet Me listeners. Sign up at stlpr.org. This episode was written, hosted, and produced by me, Luis Antonio Perez, with story editing from Alex Hoyer and Brian Heffernan. Mastering by Greg Montanu. Our engagement producer is Paola Rodriguez. Brian Heffernan is Meet Me's executive producer. Theme music by Cutta and Friends. Special thanks to Jason Rosenbaum, Rachel Lippman, Chad Davis, Fred Ehrlich, Brian Moline, and the Missouri Historical Society. Grant support comes from the James S. McDonald Foundation. Meet Me back here next time.